justice language than check your privilege. It is a phrase most likely to be met with dismissal and derision. It's a phrase viewed as an ineffective weapon hurled at someone with no other purpose than to win an argument or at least silence opposition. Often people will preempt requests to check said privilege in heated social justice conversations by saying, "I bet this is where you tell me to check my privilege," with the eye-roll-filled sarcasm seeping through. But as disliked as the phrase check your privilege is, I've found from my conversations and from witnessing the conversations of others that very few people actually know what privilege is, let alone how they would go about checking it. It is a shame that so much derision has been heaped upon a concept that so few people understand, especially one as important as privilege. Not only is the concept of privilege integral to our real understanding of issues of race in the West, it is crucial to the success of any efforts toward social justice that we make. So what is privilege? Is it, as many fear, good shit you should feel bad about having so that other people can feel better about not having it? No, it's not. But that isn't to say that understanding privilege won't make you feel bad. It might make you feel very bad. And I'm convinced that is why so many of us are quick to dismiss discussions on privilege before they even get started. We may not fully get privilege, but we have a feeling that understanding our privilege will change what we feel about ourselves and our world, and not in a good way. The definition of privilege is in reality much simpler than a lot of social justice discussions would have you believe. Privilege in the social justice context is an advantage or a set of advantages that you have that others do not. These privileges are not due 100% to your efforts, although your hard work may indeed have helped, and the benefits of these privileges are disproportionately large, or at least partially undeserved, when compared to what the privilege is for. These advantages can often be ascribed to certain social groups, privilege based on race, physical ability, gender, class, etc. But these privileges can also lie in areas that you may not have considered, like sexuality, body type, and neurological differences. It is in these advantages and their coupled disadvantages that the health and well-being of large amounts of people are often determined. If we are truly dedicated to addressing systemic oppression and inequality, we must understand the full impact of these advantages and disadvantages in order to move toward real change in our society and ourselves. Let's use a bit of my privilege as an example. I have a college degree in political science. I worked very hard for my degree, studying at all hours of the night while also taking care of a small child. I probably worked harder than many of the other students in my class, being the only black female single parent there. I also worked hard to get into college in the first place, maintaining my grades while working every evening to help my single mom make ends meet. I'm proud of my degree and the effort that I put into it. While I do have a right to be proud of my degree, it would be dishonest of me to pretend that this degree is 100% owed to my efforts. I was raised by a college-educated mother who taught me that a degree was important. I grew up as a neurotypical, non-disabled child whom school was designed to serve and for whom teachers were willing and trained to dedicate their time and efforts. My grade school education was free and open to people of all genders and economic classes. I had enough security in my home and nutrition as a child to be able to concentrate on my studies. I live in a country that provides at least some college grants and loans. I grew up in an area that allows and supports the advanced education of women. I did not have to drop out of school to help support my family. I am a documented citizen and therefore eligible for financial aid. These are just some of the many ways in which privilege helped me get my college degree. To look at this list and say, anybody could do this if they just work hard enough, would be a lie. Some of the benefits that I've received from my degree are also not what the degree in itself has earned. Benefits that should go with my degree are things like being more qualified for a job in politics, government, or social services. Also, the ability to yell, "I have a degree in political science!" during arguments about politics. I get a well-earned warm feeling when I stare at my diploma. I get to talk about my degree in political science in this book. That's about 30K in benefits, right? Right? If you can think of any more, please email me because it would make me feel a lot better about these student loans I'm still paying. But there are some benefits to my degree that are, well, let's say they're problematic. Yes, my degree makes me more qualified for jobs that utilize my political science knowledge. But that degree, any degree, made me eligible for management positions in the marketing and tech fields I've worked in, while more talented coworkers without a degree were automatically disqualified. Yes, I do deserve to feel proud of my degree, but it isn't deserving of the general reputation that I, as a college graduate, am a smarter, more responsible, and more valuable citizen than those without a degree. Especially when you consider all the advantages listed above that helped make my degree accessible to me. My degree has also gotten me higher pay than other people of color that I worked with in just about every job I've held in my adult life. And I've never worked in a field, until perhaps now, as a writer, that has even mildly utilized my political science skills. All of these advantages for a status that I didn't fully earn set me higher up in a socioeconomic hierarchy than others, and place other people below. If I were to go along thinking that my degree was 100% due to my efforts and all the benefits that I received were 100% deserved, it would then require that I think that those who did not benefit deserved to not benefit, say, an otherwise qualified coworker of mine who was exempt from the promotion I received because he did not have a degree. Because my advantage over that coworker helped me and hurt him. I would have to buy into the entire system in order to believe that it was 100% deserved. I would accept my promotion thinking that it was rightfully mine, and then I would promote other people using their degree as one of the deciding factors, thinking that it rightfully indicated that they deserved the promotion, even if that degree had nothing to do with the position I was hiring for. I would then be perpetuating the same advantages and disadvantages or system of privilege on other people. I would be part of the reason why the deck was stacked against those who were unable, for so many reasons, to get a college degree. In a fair competition truly based on skill and experience, I may have still gotten that promotion. I may well have been the most qualified person for the job. But it wasn't a fair competition. And in acting like it was fair and accepting my prize without question, I helped ensure that it would stay unfair. This right here, the realization that we may be a part of the reason why the deck is stacked against others, that we may have been contributing to it for years without our knowledge, is why the concept of privilege is so threatening to so many. We don't want to think that we are harming others. We do not want to believe that we do not deserve everything we have. And we do not want to think of ourselves as ignorant of how our world works. The concept of privilege violates everything we've been told about fairness and everything we've been told about the American dream of hard work paying off and good things happening to good people. We want to know that if we do A, we can expect B, and that those who never get B have never done A. The concept of privilege makes the world seem less safe. We want to protect our vision of a world that is fair and kind and predictable. That reaction is natural, but it doesn't make the harmful effects of unexamined privilege less real. When somebody asks you to check your privilege, they are asking you to pause and consider how the advantages you've had in life are contributing to your opinions and actions, and how the lack of disadvantages in certain areas is keeping you from fully understanding the struggles others are facing and may in fact be contributing to those struggles. It is a big ask to check your privilege. It is hard and often painful, but it's not nearly as painful as living with the pain caused by the unexamined privilege of others. You may right now be saying, "But it's not my privilege that is hurting someone, it's their lack of privilege." Don't blame me, blame the people telling them that what they have isn't as good as what I have. And in a way, that is true. But know this, a privilege has to come with somebody else's disadvantage. Otherwise, it's not a privilege. As a light-skinned black woman, I'm viewed by many in society as more intelligent and less threatening than darker-skinned black people. This is a privilege, because in order to be viewed as more intelligent, others have to be viewed as less intelligent. If black people of all shade ranges were viewed as equally intelligent until proven otherwise by their actions, then that privilege would cease to exist. But when somebody treats me as more intelligent and treats a darker-skinned black person as less intelligent, if I don't challenge that, if I just accept the unearned compliment and the better grade, the job offer, the access to more financially successful areas of society with a smile, and don't ask why it was given to me or why it's not also given to my darker-skinned counterparts, I'm benefiting from unfair privilege and helping perpetuate it further. The darker-skinned person does not really have much power to challenge that privilege. Who would listen to her when they already consider her less intelligent? If I want to live in a world where shadism, a byproduct of racism creating a hierarchy within minority races based on skin tone, doesn't exist, I have to do my part by confronting it whenever I encounter it, even if it means less benefits for me and some uncomfortable conversations. When we are willing to check our privilege, we are not only identifying areas where we are perpetuating oppression in order to stop personally perpetuating that oppression, but we are also identifying areas where we have the power and access to change the system as a whole. Where I benefit most from being able-bodied is where I have the most power and access to change a system that disadvantages disabled people. Where I benefit most from being cisgender is where I have the most power and access to change a system that disadvantages transgender people. When we identify where our privilege intersects with somebody else's oppression, we'll find our opportunities to make real change. So yes, we all need to be checking our privilege. And not just when we are told to in the middle of an argument. I recommend practicing looking for your privilege at first when you are in a neutral situation. Sit down and think about the advantages you've had in life. Have you always had good mental health? Did you grow up middle class? Are you white? Are you male? Are you non-disabled? Are you neurotypical? Are you a documented citizen of the country you live in? Did you grow up in a stable home environment? Do you have stable housing? Do you have reliable transportation? Are you cisgender? Are you straight? Are you thin, tall, or conventionally attractive? Take some time to really dig deep through all of the advantages that you have that others may not. Write them down. You may well want to list your disadvantages as well. This is not the time for that, so please resist the urge. It is natural to feel like focusing on your advantages invalidates your disadvantages and your struggles in life, but that is not what will happen. You can be both privileged in some areas of life and underprivileged in others. Both can be true at once and can impact your life at the same time. This is an exercise you should do even if you feel extremely underprivileged in life. I feel very underprivileged as a black queer woman, and it would be easy to dismiss calls to check my own privilege under the argument that it's really those with a lot of privilege who should be doing the work, and I'm too busy fighting racism and sexism to fight the few advantages I do have. But failing to check my own privilege means that my efforts to fight racism and sexism would leave out many of the women and people of color I claim to be fighting for. I march for black people. But am I marching for black trans women, disabled black people, incarcerated black people as well? The number of people I'd be leaving behind and continuing to oppress by refusing to check my privilege would make my efforts ineffective at best and harmful at worst. If thinking about your privilege without addressing your oppression is hard for you and you need to write down your lack of privilege later, that is fine. But please, dedicate this time to seeing how you can make your understanding of justice and equality more inclusive. Once you've written down a nice long list of privilege, start thinking about how this privilege might have influenced not only your status in society, but your experience with and understanding of the world at large. How might your privilege have impacted your ideas on racism, on education, on the environment? Then start seeking out work on these subjects by people who don't have your same privilege, and listen when those people are speaking. Being privileged doesn't mean that you are always wrong and people without privilege are always right. It means that there is a good chance you are missing a few very important pieces of the puzzle. Practice this often, especially when thinking about social or political issues. After having practiced looking at my privilege more formally, I casually revisit this exercise whenever I'm confronted with a new privilege that I was previously unaware of, and again at the start of every year, as a way to refocus on my social justice goals. Get used to that uncomfortable feeling that arises when you discover that perhaps your privilege is hindering your ability to truly understand or address an issue. Get used to that pang of guilt that comes with realizing yet another area of life where you've benefited at the expense of others. It will not kill you. You can withstand it. You want to be more comfortable with this, so that when you are confronted with your privilege in a stressful situation, like a Facebook argument that suddenly takes a turn for the worse, you will be able to limit your defensiveness enough to listen and learn. This will also help you better empathize with the feelings of anger, fear, and shame that people feel when confronted with their privilege, and may help you approach someone about their privilege with more generosity. It is also easier to explain privilege to someone else, if you should choose to do so, if you are familiar with explaining it to yourself. When you first became aware of an area of your privilege, it did not appear to you as privilege. You had to be able to see what your advantage was, that others did not have that advantage, and that it was influencing your words and decisions in a way that could be harming others. Remembering this might allow you to put more detail into your entreaties for people to check their privilege, and may increase the chances they will actually try. No. You do not owe someone who is oppressing you with their unexamined privilege any particular kindness or education. But know that you have unexamined privilege too, no matter how woke you think you are, and someone will be telling you to check your privilege while you try to battle your own defensiveness as you figure out what the hell they are talking about. If someone confronts you with your privilege from a place of anger or even hatred, if someone does not want to take the time or does not have the emotional energy to further explain to you where your privilege lies, know that it is still a kindness. Try to remember that the alternative to not being made aware of your privilege, no matter how it may sting, is your continued participation in the oppression of others. Someone is giving you an opportunity to do better, no matter how unpleasant the delivery. Thank them. Once you are aware of your privilege, you can get to work on dismantling it. This is where checking your privilege really pays off. Here are some examples of where you can find both privilege and opportunities to help create change in your day-to-day life. Does your privilege mean that you are more likely to sit in a manager's meeting while others are not? Ask why there are no disabled people in the room. Does your privilege mean that politicians are begging for your political support? Ask what they are going to do for people of color next time they knock on your door to hand you a flyer. Were you able to get a fancy private education as a child? Use your resulting financial security to support levies to improve public schools. Don't have to juggle work and children? Use the promotion that added flexibility helped you get to support employer-funded childcare and family leave programs. Have the schedule flexibility to attend a PTA meeting? At your next meeting, ask them to move future meeting times to hours that more working parents can attend and give parents other ways to contribute if they can't be there. The possibilities of where you can leverage your privilege to make real, measurable change toward a better world are endless. Every day you are given opportunities to make the world better by making yourself a little uncomfortable and asking, who doesn't have this same freedom or opportunity that I'm enjoying now? These daily interactions are how systems of oppression are maintained, but with awareness, they can be how we tear those systems down. So please, check your privilege. Check it often. Chapter 5. What is intersectionality, and why do I need it? I'm so sorry, I said as my phone buzzed again. Can you excuse me for a minute? I have this thing I need to take care of with my kids really quick. My dinner companion graciously nodded in reply, and I rushed upstairs to my hotel room, to my laptop. Come on, come on, I said to myself as I tried to quickly run the online program. I knew that every minute this took made me more and more rude and more a liar. No, there was no issue with my kids, and yes, it's pretty shitty to use them as an excuse. Hey, consider it a rare indulgence for single parents. But I was damned if I was going to say, sorry, I have to leave our dinner to go run a program to block thousands of Twitter trolls who think I hate black men before this shit goes viral and I can never use Twitter again. There's no rescuing dinner after that. It had started quietly enough weeks earlier. I had found out that a famous black male musician was coming to town to perform. This musician, who shall remain nameless, was long believed by many, including myself, to be a sexual predator of multiple young black women and teenage girls. How could a man so notorious for suspicion of such heinous offenses sell out an arena in liberal Seattle? How was this man still rich and famous? I tweeted out some of my frustration, expressing the desire that if he'd never see jail time due to a society that did not value black womanhood, he would at least be forever reminded of his misdeeds in any venture he tried to undertake, plus a lot of swear words. I was angry. I really care about the plight of black women and girls. The tweets got some likes and a few retweets, but as I said, society doesn't really value black womanhood, and the conversation didn't gain much traction. That is, until Hotep Twitter got hold of my tweets. Tuhotep Twitter, think black men's rights activists with the added fun of wildly inaccurate Egyptian origin mythology on Twitter. The fact that I would use so many swear words on a black man accused of assaulting multiple young black women led them to only one conclusion. I hated black men. Not only did I hate black men, but I was on the side of the lynch mobs, on the side of the school-to-prison pipeline. I was the house Negro, the high yellow bed wench who'd spread her legs for her white master. For real, these are words that have been sent to me. And before I knew what was happening, I had thousands of angry black men and some black women interrupting my dinner with buzzes on my phone, notifying me that they were working as hard as possible to drown my Twitter feed in hatred. To those clamoring to send me hateful messages, I had betrayed black people with my comments against a black musician. I had taken the side of white oppressors by speaking so publicly about a black man's crimes. But this is because their idea of blackness and the oppressions that black people face did not include black women and the specific oppressions we face from being both black and women. While they were fighting to defend this black man, they were giving little thought to his black female victims or the other black women who may have been harmed by seeing someone so widely known for harming black women lauded so publicly. This sort of hurtful denial of the various oppressions that I and many others have to navigate is something I'm often forced to confront in office meetings, in social justice forums, in feminist activist groups, in government and social programs aimed at fighting inequality, and most often on the internet. I'd seen the consequences of this sort of anger at people who demand that their various identities be taken into account when discussing larger social groups, and I'd seen how quickly this anger can turn into a full-scale online mob. I'd seen how these campaigns of harassment can take on a life of their own, lasting weeks, months, even years. I knew that it could lead to doxing campaigns, where angry internet vigilantes publish your home address and work info to the masses. I knew that there was a limited amount of time to contain this problem before there would be no saving my online presence, and I'd have to leave my Twitter account for dead. Twitter may seem to many like a frivolous thing to be in a panic over, but it is not just a fun online community for me. Twitter is a huge part of my job. As a black woman, it is very hard to build a platform for your writing in a white male-dominated industry that shows little interest in giving black women regular columns or placing them behind a news anchor's desk. Twitter is a huge tool in finding and maintaining my audience, and it is how many editors who want to commission the work of women of color find me. I simply could not afford to be pushed off of that platform. I scrambled to block as many of these attackers as I could in an attempt to stem this assault in as much time as I felt I could be away without worrying my very patient dinner companion too much or making her feel abandoned. Then I closed my laptop, said an atheist prayer for the best, and went back downstairs to apologize and finish dinner. By the next day, the uproar had mostly died down. I'd been able to cut off access to my account to a large number of Twitter users that online instigators were hoping to send to my page to harass me. When the return on troll investment, the barrage of hate met with my frantic pleas and denials, had proved underwhelming, the bullies had moved on. I breathed a sigh of relief at the crisis averted, but then I was almost as quickly overcome with sadness. All I had done was express anger at the abuse of black women. All I had done was ask people to care about us as they did about others. All I had done was ask for the fight for black lives to include black women too. And for that, I had to block tens of thousands of black people, my people, who wanted me to pay for my audacity. And I, like so many other prominent black women on social media, felt very alone and very abused. Because in our struggle for justice and equality, we are often exploited and discarded. White women will heap praise on my words, calling for the destruction of the patriarchy, and then turn around and ask why I have to be so divisive, or say dismissively that I sound like Al Sharpton when I dare bring up race. Black men will follow me by the dozens after each essay I write, calling out white supremacy, but will forget all of that and call me a feminist tool of slave masters when I demand that black women be treated with respect and dignity by everyone, even black men. And even though Black Lives Matter was founded by black women, even though black women have been at the heart of every feminist movement in this country's history, nobody marches for us when we are raped, when we are killed, when we are denied work and equal pay. Nobody marches for us. Intersectionality. The belief that our social justice movements must consider all of the intersections of identity, privilege, and oppression that people face in order to be just and effective is the number one requirement of all of the work that I do. When I first learned about intersectionality in college, I honestly had no idea what a huge part of my life it would later become. What was at first an interesting, if not abstract, theory I wrote about for college papers became a matter of my political, social, spiritual, and yes, even physical survival. Because I am not capable of cutting myself to pieces. I'm not capable of cutting away my blackness in order to support feminism that views the needs of women of color as divisive inconveniences. I'm not capable of cutting away womanhood in order to stand by black men who prey on black women. I'm a black woman each and every minute of every day, and I need you to march for me too. While this book is about race, I'm sure you know that we as people are far more than just our race. But even further, our experience of race is shaped by far more than just our skin color and hair texture. And just as racial identity is not the only type of identity in our society, racial oppression is not the only form of oppression in our society. Racial privilege is not the only form of privilege in our society. Each of us has a myriad of identities, our gender, class, race, sexuality, and so much more, that inform our experiences in life and our interactions with the world. As we saw when we were checking our privilege, the different hierarchies, privileges, and oppressions assigned to these identities affect our lives in many ways. These privileges and oppressions do not exist in a vacuum, however, and can combine with each other, compound each other, mitigate each other, and contradict each other. We walk through the world with all our identities at once, and therefore our day has an endless number of possible combinations of outcomes, depending on how individual events and situations we encounter interact with our individual identities. I'm a black queer woman. If I'm harassed on the street, I don't know if it is because I'm black, if it's because I'm a woman, or if it's because I'm queer. In fact, it may be all three reasons at once, but many of our social justice movements would fail to consider the ways in which our multiple identities interact or intersect. For example, when feminist groups are discussing how to fight the street harassment of women. As a black, queer, middle-class woman, my queer identity may often be overlooked by anti-racist or feminist movements. My female identity may be overlooked by anti-racist or queer movements. My black identity may be overlooked by feminist or queer movements, and my middle-class identity may well cause me to overlook poor people in all movements. And when that happens, none of them can really help me or many others. This is very often the case in our movements and our society at large. Feminist movements, for example, often fail to consider the different needs and challenges that many women of color face when they differ from what white women face. I've done a fair amount of work in support of reproductive rights, and I'm still surprised at how often reproductive rights groups claim that they are fighting for reproductive rights for all women, yet consistently ignore the documented racial bias in the medical field that keeps many women of color from accessing reproductive health care, regardless of law. So how does this happen? How do our social justice efforts so often fail to help the most vulnerable in our populations? This is primarily a result of unexamined privilege. Because of how rarely our privilege is examined, even our social justice movements will tend to focus on the most privileged and most well-represented people within those groups. Anti-racism groups will often tend to prioritize the needs of straight men of color. Feminist groups will tend to prioritize the needs of white women. LGBTQ groups will tend to prioritize the needs of white, gay, cisgender men. Disability rights groups will tend to prioritize the needs of disabled white men. Imagine where this leaves a disabled Latinx trans woman on any group's priority list. Because the needs of the most privileged are usually the ones prioritized, they are often the only ones considered when discussing solutions to oppression and inequality. These solutions, not surprisingly, often leave the underprivileged populations in our movements behind. The idea of intersectionality provides a more inclusive alternative to the status quo. Coined by the brilliant race theorist and civil rights activist Kimberly Crenshaw in 1989, the term intersectionality was born from Crenshaw's work to shed light on the ways in which experiences in both race and gender intertwine to uniquely impact the lives of Black women and women of color. Crenshaw referred to those intersections of race and gender as intersectionality and stressed the need to consider intersectionality in our social justice movements. Intersectionality as a theory and practice was quickly adopted by prominent Black feminists to describe the need they saw for a more holistic view of race and gender. From there, intersectionality spread to a large section of feminist scholarship and activism and was expanded to include class, ability, and sexuality as well. Intersectionality and the necessity of considering intersectionality applies to more than just our social justice efforts. Our government, education system, economic system, and social systems all should consider intersectionality if they have any hope of effectively serving the public. Intersectionality helps ensure that fewer people are left behind and that our efforts to do better for some do not make things far worse for others. Intersectionality helps us stay true to our values of justice and equality by helping to keep our privilege from getting in our way. Intersectionality makes our systems more effective and more fair. So if intersectionality makes all of our social justice efforts so much better, why isn't it a more prominent part of our social justice movements? I believe there are many reasons that may be why social justice movements have been slow to adopt intersectional practices. Intersectionality slows things down. The simple truth is, when you are only considering the needs of a select few, it's a lot easier to make what looks like progress than when you have to consider the needs of a diverse group of people. This is where you often hear people say things like, "Well, let's just work on what the majority needs first, and we'll get to the rest later." Intersectionality brings people face to face with their privilege. People in general do not like to recognize the ways in which they may be unfairly advantaged over other people. To embrace intersectionality is to also embrace the knowledge of those advantages and to acknowledge that your advantages may have kept you from first seeing the disadvantages others face. This becomes even stickier in social justice movements where you are targeting oppression. When you are supposed to be fighting the evils of the man, you don't want to realize that you've become the man within your own movement. Intersectionality decentralizes people who are used to being the primary focus of the movements they are a part of. If your needs have always been among the prioritized in your social justice movements, that is going to feel like the natural order of things for you. It may well have not even occurred to you that others within your movement have never felt prioritized. While you may, in theory, want others to have equal priority within your movements, when put into practice, that does mean less time and attention for your specific needs, and that can feel really unfair, even if it isn't. Intersectionality forces people to interact with, listen to, and consider people they don't usually interact with, listen to, or consider. People like to form groups with people they consider similar to themselves. Many of us spend a lot of our days with people like us, people with similar backgrounds, goals, identities, and personalities. This is human nature. This also means that our social justice efforts often self-segregate in this way as well. Intersectionality requires that we break free from these divides and reach out to people we have not reached out to in the past. While many people would not consider this unpleasant, it is often uncomfortable, at least at first. These challenges to intersectionality are not easy to overcome, but it is worth the effort. I strongly believe that the vast majority of people who set out to fight racism, sexism, ableism, and other forms of oppression do so because they really do want to make the world a better place for all people. But if you don't embrace intersectionality, even if you make progress for some, you will look around one day and find that you've become the oppressor of others. So how do you increase the intersectionality in your discussions of race? Here are some questions to ask yourself. How might race, gender, sexuality, ability, class, or sex impact this subject? You don't have to have the exact answers to this question, but asking it of yourself will give you ideas of other viewpoints to seek out. Could the identity differences between me and the person I'm talking with about race be contributing to our differences of opinion or perspective? Are the people in my racial justice conversations and the opinions being considered truly representing the diversity of identities that interact with the subject matter being addressed? Does my scholarship of racial justice reflect the diversity of identities impacted by racial oppression? Who writes the books and articles I'm using to help inform my opinions? Am I listening to people whose identities and experiences differ from mine? Am I looking for what I don't know? Am I asking people if they notice anything missing from my racial justice efforts? Am I shifting some focus and power away from the most privileged in the conversation? Am I letting those we don't hear from very often speak first? Am I making conversation accessible to everyone who wants to participate? Am I prioritizing the opinions of those who are often overlooked? Am I providing a safe space for marginalized people to speak out? If you find yourself saying, well, disabled people never talk to me about this, or I just never hear from black women, then you need to ask yourself why and what you can do to make people feel safe to speak up around you. Privilege has been used to silence people for so long that you will need to put out the effort to let people know that you will value and respect their input. Don't expect that trust to form immediately with your intentions. It's not enough for you to personally believe in intersectionality. We need to start demanding intersectionality of all those who seek to join us in our social justice movements. If you want to call attention to the need for greater focus on intersectionality in your discussions of race and racial justice efforts, here are some things to remember. Most people don't know what intersectionality is, and unknown words can put people on the defensive. You may need to explain further, with examples of the intersecting identities not being considered, if you don't want people to just pretend like they understand, but then never put intersectionality into practice. It's often best to start first with real-life examples of how this conversation or project could be more intersectional. The concept of intersectionality is more easily understood when viewed as an opportunity to do better and do more, instead of just an examination of the ways in which these efforts are failing. Intersectionality is absolutely always important to all discussions of race and social justice. Do not let other people bully you out of prioritizing it. It is important that our efforts to end oppression for some do not perpetuate oppression of others. Remember, while embracing intersectionality is vital for our efforts of fighting racism and other oppression, it applies to all aspects of our lives, not just our movements. Who gets to speak at company meetings? Whom do you vote for? How is your child's school curriculum developed? Who is considered when developing environmental policy? Everything we do publicly can be made more inclusive and uplifting with intersectionality, and everything we do can become exclusionary and oppressive without it. Intersectionality and the recognition and confrontation of our privilege can make us better people with better lives. Chapter 6. Is police brutality really about race? Just got pulled over for driving while black. Here's hoping I get out of it safely. This was a tweet I sent out July of 2015, along with a photo of the officer who had pulled me over. I was driving with my two brothers on the freeway, moving with traffic slightly over the speed limit. The ticket given put me at 1 mile per hour over the speed limit. I watched the motorcycle cop cross three lanes of traffic to pick my vehicle out of the crowd, slowing all traffic to guide me back to the other side of the busy freeway. As we waited for the officer to walk up to the passenger side window, my brothers and I tried to calm ourselves down. Just stay calm. Don't ask any questions. We'll be okay. My brother Aham repeated in a voice that betrayed his fear, and also his determination to see us all get through this encounter intact. It was then that I sent the alert to friends and family. The tweet I sent once we were stopped on the side of the road is similar to what many of my black friends send out these days when they are pulled over. This message is sent out not so much to complain, but to notify friends and family that if something should happen to you in the near future, this was the likely cause. As we've learned, witnesses are the only defense people of color seem to have against police brutality, and often even that isn't enough. Our encounter with the officer was over quickly, although it felt like an eternity. He was brusque and professional, while we silently sat in fear, watching our hands, to make sure they didn't betray us with any sudden movements, any threatening gestures. Aham's hands shook as he opened my glove compartment to get my vehicle registration, slowly and clearly telling the officer, "I'm reaching into the glove compartment now," and waiting for the officer's nod before moving. Watching my brother carefully reach for the glove compartment, I was reminded of one time when I was pulled over at 16. I quickly reached for the glove compartment when asked for license and registration, and the officer's hand immediately went to his gun as he yelled, "Stop!" As I sat there, frozen in fear, he proceeded to lecture me to never reach for anything in front of a cop without saying what I was doing first. "That's a good way to get yourself shot, young lady," he said to me. Then he nodded and took his hand off of his gun, satisfied with the favor he had done me by not shooting a 16-year-old girl for reaching for her identification. But this officer did not shout or reach for his gun. He simply wrote out my ticket and then drove off. When the officer was gone, we sat for a moment and collected ourselves. We looked at each other, grateful that we were all okay. I sent out a quick tweet letting everyone know that we were okay, and then I started driving again, dreading the rest of the long trip that moments earlier we had been looking forward to, and driving slowly enough to anger everyone else on the road. When I got home, I had dozens of messages waiting for me from friends and community members, voicing concern at my first tweet and relief at my second. Many of those messages came from other Black people who related to the fear behind my initial tweet and shared their own stories of their DWBs. But there were plenty of other messages from people wondering why I had brought race into it at all. Why do you assume it's about race? You have no proof it was anything other than a traffic stop. Wouldn't it be better to just assume good intentions on behalf of the cop? How do you know it's about race? And the truth is, I didn't know it was about race, and I still don't. There's a very good chance that I just won that horrible lottery, and my car, with three Black individuals, was the one car to be pulled over out of pure luck. Maybe we're all just really unlucky, as a race. And while I may have been pulled over due to luck of the draw, the thing is, I can't ask why. The last time my brother asked a cop why he'd been pulled over, the cop leaned into the vehicle and asked ominously, "Are we going to have a problem here?" So he doesn't ask anymore. And after seeing what happened to Sandra Bland, I certainly don't ask either. If we don't know if each individual encounter with police officers is truly about race, and if we can't safely ask, why do we talk about police brutality like it is about race? At its core, police brutality is about power and corruption. Police brutality is about the intersection of fear and guns. Police brutality is about accountability, and the power and corruption that enable police brutality put all citizens of every race at risk. But it does not put us at risk equally, and the numbers bear that out. My fear as a Black driver is real. The fact is that Black drivers are 23% more likely to be pulled over than white drivers, between 1.5 and 5 times more likely to be searched, while shown to be less likely than whites to turn up contraband in these searches, and more likely to be ticketed and arrested in those stops. This increase in stops, searches, and arrests also leads to a 3.5 to 4 times higher probability that Black people will be killed by cops. This increase is the same for Native Americans interacting with police, a shamefully underreported statistic. Even when we aren't arrested or killed, we are still more likely to be abused and dehumanized in our stops. A 2016 review of a 13-month period showed that Oakland police handcuffed 1,466 Black people in non-arrest traffic stops, and only 72 white people. And a 2016 study by the Center for Policing Equity found that Blacks were almost 4 times more likely to be subject to force from police, including force by hand, such as hitting and choking, pepper spray, taser, and gun, than white people. So maybe that time I got pulled over wasn't about race. Maybe the time I'd been pulled over before that wasn't about race. Maybe even the time before that. But those who demand the smoking gun of a racial slur or swastika or burning cross before they will believe that an individual encounter with the police might be about race are ignoring what we know and what the numbers are bearing out. Something is going on, and it is not right. We are being targeted. And you can try to explain away one statistic due to geography, one away due to income. You can find reasons for numbers all day. But the fact remains, all across the country, in every type of neighborhood, people of color are being disproportionately criminalized. This is not all in our heads. When we first learn to drive, it's with the same excitement of anybody else newly behind the wheel. A bit of fear mixed with a sense of freedom and power. But while our white friends quickly settle into the mundanity of the daily commute, we never get that sense of ease. The first time I was pulled over was at age 16, for going 5 miles over the speed limit in a wealthy white neighborhood. I explained that I hadn't realized the speed limit had been recently lowered, but the cop wanted to know if I was drunk, if I was on drugs, what he would find if he looked in my trunk. I believe I answered, snacks. A few months later, I was pulled over for not coming to a complete stop on a suburban road, empty of all traffic except for me and the officer. I've been stopped for having my vehicle tabs expired by 1 day, even though it was still within the month indicated on the tab, which meant that the officer was scanning my plates for the hell of it. Time and time again, the questions I was asked were along the same lines. What are you doing in this neighborhood? Have you been drinking? Do I smell marijuana? Do you have any illegal substances or weapons in your car? I know it sounds silly, but it surprised me every time. I've never been a big drinker. I've never driven drunk. And weed never did anything for me. I have no criminal record, no past indication of dangerous driving or violence. And yet by the age of 18, I couldn't shake the feeling that cops were out to get me. And this experience is even worse for many black men, and for those who do have criminal records that give cops even more reason to harass them. Like myself, most people of color I know do not enjoy driving. We have moments where we forget what our blackness means behind the wheel, when we are enjoying a great song on the radio or leaving a fun event. For a few moments, we are driving like any other carefree American. But then our pulses rise at the sight of an officer on the street. Will this be the time? The moment the lights on the police cruiser go on, we know that's for us. We are watching our speed and using our